It could happen to anyone. Any one of our children, any one of our family, a good, wonderful, kind person that you love could suddenly disappear, that you could never see them again. You can never talk about that person without everyone in the room thinking, oh, she's the one who was murdered.
This will be homicide case number 95336. The trees that can be seen in the distance is the area of the ravine where the bodies have been located.
This was a brutal, brutal slaying. My name is Carol Daly, and back in 1980, I was assigned as a detective in the homicide unit with Sacramento County Sheriff's Department. Sabrina Gonzalez and John Riggins were college co-eds, 18 years old. They were just bright, lovely young couple, carefree, and not a worry in the world. The disappearance was at Christmas time, 1980. They were headed to a birthday party for Sabrina's sister, Andrea.
Sabrina and John left the condo and were on their way, but they never showed. And I started thinking what could possibly have gone wrong. First, we were told they found the van. And I ran to a phone to call my dad. And he said, Andrea, they think they have found the bodies.
It was sickening, the horrificness of what we were seeing and what they must have gone through. They had duct taped around their eyes and around their mouth. Looking at them, we knew their throats had been cut, and they were dumped, just like trash. Whoever was responsible for that was a cold-hearted animal, thoughtless, senseless in taking a life just for pleasure. Anybody that had done such a horrific crime, somebody was going to know who did it, and somebody was going to send in a tip. And I really thought the case was going to be solved within weeks. And as the case went on and on and on, I think we had lost hope.
32 years they have been dead. How many people, how many years, how much effort does it take to put one horrible person away for life?
32 years later, it turns out there was a critical piece of evidence in the van that would end up solving the case. It was Sabrina's birthday present to Andrea.
All this time we've been waiting, all this time, the answer was there.
I'm Troy Roberts.
The Sweetheart Murders.
The wheels of justice turn slowly, but I've never covered a story quite like this. It's hard to imagine that it would take more than three decades to find the killer and bring him to trial.
And that said defendant did unlawfully and with malice aforethought murder Sabrina Marie Gonzalez.
32 years. Unbelievable. That's why I want it over with. I want to have a little peace before I die.
Okay, I think we're ready to commence.
Sabrina Gonzalez's mother, Kim, and her father, George, weren't sure they'd live to see the day.
It's a scab on your heart, and it just keeps getting pulled off, and you bleed again and again and again, you know, and you just don't know how much you can keep going.
It is so much worse when someone is killed instead of dying a natural death. But it is also worse to have a murder unsolved.
Over the decades, Andrea Gonzalez Rosenstein has remained devoted to keeping her baby sister's memory alive.
Tell me about Sabrina.
She loved kids. She loved being with kids, working with kids. She loved medicine. She wanted to be a physical therapist. And she was such a good
person and so innocent and so sweet and so wonderful.
Andrea named her firstborn Sabrina, and after having her third child, she decided to adopt three more.
She wanted to have six kids, and I did it for her with the thought of I'm having the family she didn't get to have. I also wanted to keep horses in my life and introduce them to my children and let them know that this is something that I did with Sabrina with great joy and fun. She's still with us. I feel like her spirit is still with us.
Back in the summer of 1980, Andrea was already attending the University of California at Davis when her sister moved in with her. Sabrina was excited to begin her own college career. That summer, Sabrina met John Riggins while working for the town's recreation department.
He was really her first boyfriend, and she fell in love with him. John was so much fun. He was funny and lighthearted, and he loved sports. They were perfect together.
John had been a popular high school athlete in Davis, but he stood out for another reason as well.
When he was much younger, he had this mop of red hair that got a lot of attention.
Even as a toddler, people came up and touched his head all the time. And it was almost like bringing good luck or something. If there was a sports photographer, John's picture was in there.
Kate and Dr. Richard Riggins, an orthopedic surgeon, were proud of their son. John was considering following in his father's footsteps.
Do you ever think about what kind of man your son would have become? He would have been 51 years old now.
Since he was murdered, I haven't given much thought to what he would have been as an adult. I just always left him there as a freshman at UC Davis. He's still been 18 years old and never really pushed it beyond that.
The night of December 20th, 1980, Sabrina and John were expected at the surprise party for Andrea's 22nd birthday. But they never showed and never called.
First thing in the morning, it was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and then I knew something really bad had happened because she would have never not come home.
It was out of character.
Oh, my God. I knew where she was all the time. She knew where I was all the time. We didn't do that.
When you realized he hadn't come home, what was going through your mind?
It was so foggy that night. You could not see anything.
And we just got out and drove in increasing circles, looking in the ditches and looking for some evidence of an auto accident. And the possibility that they'd been kidnapped and murdered was not even considered. I mean, we didn't want to consider that.
Sabrina and John had been missing for 36 hours when police found the Riggins family van, abandoned about 30 miles east of Davis in Sacramento County. Former detective Carol Daly.
There was nothing inside the van to indicate that something horrible had happened at that point. We were hoping to find them alive.
But a few hours later, Detective Daly received the call that the bodies had been found just under a mile away, discarded in that ravine.
There are areas of blood on the leaves and ground in between signs number 3 and 5.
It was so traumatic to see them and their bodies disposed of the way that they were. I've just never been able to forget it.
There were signs that Sabrina had been sexually assaulted. John had a head injury, suggesting he fought to protect her.
18, they're just children. How are the parents going to be able to handle all this?
I understand that you wake up in the middle of the night thinking of your son.
He comes into our thoughts, and like a nightmare, a small nightmare, most nights.
I can't see ever getting rid of that haunting figures that I see every now and then. Their bodies there in the ditch. That's never going to go away.
The case became known as the Sweetheart Murders. investigators from two counties mobilized to hunt down this sadistic killer. But they had no idea just how difficult that would be.
And now, as a community of people who shared in John and Sabrina's lives,
as the town of Davis said goodbye to the two sweethearts, their chilling murders had police fearing a serial killer could be on the loose.
When you cut somebody's throat with a knife, you either have to be pretty desperate or you have to be pretty cold-blooded, I would say.
Investigator Ron Garverick is with the Sacramento District Attorney's Office.
The suspect did some planning. He came there with a sharp knife or some other weapon. He brought some tape with him.
The videotaping is at sign number 3, which indicates a large area of blood.
Police received hundreds of tips. They even released this composite sketch of a suspicious man spotted in the area.
The officer is standing at the side of the road at the area where the bodies are located, just over the edge.
This is the kind of rough brush that the bodies were found in?
Yeah.
It's just by luck that the officers found the bodies, right?
Yeah, because the roadway was at one elevation, and the ravine was probably, 8 to 10 feet down. And looking straight across, you wouldn't see it. So somebody had to be somewhat familiar with the area.
But the investigation went nowhere, and the trail went cold. Year after year, the lack of answers only added to the family's pain.
I despaired that we would never find the person that killed him. I would say the first year was really bad, really devastating. I think for 5 years, I really was fragile. That's the best way to put it, very fragile.
6 years passed, and then a tip led police to revisit another double murder that happened around the same time to see if there was any connection.
The body of 22-year-old Craig Miller was found near Bass Lake in El Dorado County, shot 3 times in the head. His girlfriend, Mary Beth Sowers, is still missing tonight and feared dead by lawmen.
Like John and Sabrina, this college couple was abducted from a public place, killed execution style, and then dumped around the Sacramento area. But in this case, police quickly made an arrest and got a conviction. The killer was this man, Gerald Gallego, a violent sexual predator. But on the night John and Sabrina were killed, he had an airtight alibi. He was already in jail. And that's why police, looking at the sweetheart's case years later, arrived at an unusual theory that John and Sabrina's murder was a copycat crime committed by Gallego's friends to try and clear him.
Well, then it couldn't be Gerald that's the murderer because of the fact that this killer's still out there. Hundreds, if not thousands of hours went in to prove that theory, and arrests were made behind it.
Davis police issued murder arrest warrants for
Hunt. In 1989, 9 years after the sweetheart murders, police arrested David Hunt, Gallego's half-brother, who also had a criminal past. Believing he had help, they rounded up Hunt's wife, Sue Ellen, and his partners in crime, Richard Thompson and Doug Lehner. They became known as the Hunt Group. All four were charged with the murders of John and Sabrina.
I'm so angry for being accused of something like that.
Don't let that anger go, brother.
David Hunt and Doug Lehner maintain their innocence to this day.
Did you kill Sabrina and John?
No.
Did your brother mastermind these killings?
No. By this time, my brother was dead to me.
Both men admit they were drug addicts and thieves, but insist they would never commit murder.
Both of you were described as sophisticated, savvy desperados.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
But dumb old criminal is what I was, doing dumb old criminal things.
Those dumb things Lehner did included stealing bed sheets from hotels. But this time, even with no physical evidence, he and the other members of the Hunt Group were facing the death penalty
It's ludicrous. Think about it.
So this wasn't designed to free Gerald?
Absolutely.
You know what I have to say about Gerald?
I feel the same way.
On the eve of the Hunt Group's trial, there was a stunning development. And it involved that birthday gift Sabrina had intended to give her sister Andrea, a blanket. Apparently the killer had unwrapped it and left semen stains that went unnoticed for years. Those stains could now be tested for DNA, a forensic tool that didn't exist at the time of the murders. Police asked for blood samples from the accused.
What did your attorney advise you to do?
They came to me, actually, he told me that the bottom line is, if you did this, or have knowledge of it, don't let him do this.
Why?
Because it'll send you to death row. Now, my response was very simple. Let's get it done. How soon?
Lehner, too, was certain the DNA would prove his innocence.
I ran down the hall tap dancing. I was so ecstatic. No, case is over now. We got him. Because the whole thing was a setup to begin with. Now they couldn't get away with it.
And as they predicted, the DNA on the blanket did not match any of the men in the Hunt Group. So in January 1993, all the charges were dropped.
The people are removed for dismissal based on insufficiency of evidence.
By then, David Hunt and his co-defendants had spent 3 years in jail.
Doug Lehner is a free man today.
They framed me and almost got away with it. I could be going to the gas chamber today, and that's an outrage!
Investigators were back to square one.
I thought it was over with. I was doing my best to get it buried and to get on with my life.
To not know who did it and why is something you never stop thinking about. Is the person out there killing other people?
After their son John was murdered.
Oh, it's so pretty.
Dr. Richard Riggins and his wife Kate still had two younger children to raise. Son Robert and daughter Carrie.
Why did you move from Davis?
I couldn't stand all the memories. And when you went to the hospital to go to work, you passed the morgue every day. And that was just too much for me.
The lack of an arrest made it even harder. But by 2002, DNA science had advanced even more. The state crime lab was now routinely comparing DNA from cold cases to that of convicted criminals stored in a new database. When they uploaded the DNA from those semen stains on the blanket, incredibly, there was a hit.
The DNA match had been found.
Scientists called it a 1 in 240 trillion match.
It belonged to a suspect who is currently in prison up in the state of Washington.
The suspect's name was Richard Hirschfield. Local investigators had never heard of him, but they soon learned he had a very dark past.
Who is Richard Hirschfield?
Richard Hirschfield is a serial sexual predator.
Prosecutor Dawn Blade.
He has victimized children and adults throughout his lifetime.
Richard Joseph Hirschfield.
I just think he is a vile human being. And he is the worst of the worst.
At the time of the DNA hit, then 53-year-old Hirschfield was in prison for molesting two little girls. Many years earlier, in 1975, he had been convicted of rape in Northern California.
We're lucky to be alive, really.
In 2006, 48 Hours spoke to his California victims, two sisters, Marge and Michelle, who didn't want their last names used.
He had the gun. It had a silencer on it. No one would have heard.
They were 22 and 16 at the time he entered their apartment demanding money. When they told him they had none.
He was mad. All right then, who wants to be raped? And then my sister offered herself instead of me.
Anybody in my position would have done the same thing. She was my little sister.
What are you thinking about right now?
I
how it affected my life and made me fearful.
Hirschfeld served only 5 years in prison for that crime. He was paroled in July 1980.
He was able to convince people in the corrections field that he was not a danger.
5 months later, John and Sabrina were murdered.
If only he'd stayed in prison a little bit longer, if only he hadn't come to Davis, it just brought it all back again.
But this time, Hirschfeld wasn't going anywhere. He remained behind bars in Washington in the child molestation case, while California investigators cemented theirs.
There's a lot of work that goes on after the cold hit. Some people think you hear the DNA match, we have the suspect, that's the end of the story. This person came out of the blue. Did they have any connection to Sacramento? Did they know anyone in Davis?
The answer to both questions was yes. Hirschfeld once had friends in Davis who lived across the street from the condo Andrea and Sabrina shared. And that's where authorities believe Sabrina and John were abducted.
So this was 5 days before Christmas?
Yes.
Most of the students had gone home.
Like every university town, they just start their break. And this place is pretty vacant.
Right. And because this place was deserted, no one could hear their cries if they were abducted in the complex.
It's that, and that night was extremely foggy. So your visibility is way down.
Do you believe Hirschfeld was stalking Sabrina?
Yes. I think Sabrina was selected because of her looks. She was very attractive. And I don't think it was a coincidence that he happened upon her.
Investigators also learned that Richard Hirschfeld had a brother, Joseph, who was living in this house near Sacramento at the time of the murders. It's just a few miles from where the bodies were dumped.
The assignment that my partner and I had was to go talk to him and ask him what he knew about his brother, Richard, in 1980. And we let him know that Richard's a suspect in two murders from 1980. He was a little nervous throughout the interview. But my partner tells me, when you said DNA, he started shaking. We didn't know what to think.
The next day, Joseph Hirschfeld got into his car and committed suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning. The note he left behind was a bombshell.
I have been living with this horror for 20 years. Richard did commit those murders, but I was there. I didn't kill anyone, but my DNA is still there.
Joseph's DNA was never found in the Riggins van, and no one knows exactly what role he played in the murders. But even with strong evidence, Richard's DNA and Joseph's suicide note, the case was moving at a snail's pace.
It took 10 years to bring this case to trial.
That's true.
Why?
When the death penalty is on the table, typically takes longer. Obviously, the stakes are higher. The sheer volume of materials was overwhelming and daunting.
The case had over 200,000 pages of discovery. Hirschfeld's defense team would file more than 200 motions and be granted many delays.
And every delay was to his benefit, not ours. The victims should have a right to. We have a right to get this done. It cost us, the state of California, the taxpayer, millions of dollars.
Is the system broken?
You know what? I really do believe there is something horribly wrong with it.
And time took its toll. Sabrina and Andrea's father, George, received a devastating diagnosis. He had Alzheimer's.
He wanted to be at the trial. He wanted to see justice done to the man who murdered his baby. And all he kept saying is it going to be fast enough? Am I going to be able to be there? Am I going to be able to testify?
Finally, in September 2012, 10 years after the DNA hit and almost 32 years after the notorious murders, the trial of Richard Hirschfeld was set to begin. When his capital murder trial finally begins, the now 63-year-old Richard Hirschfeld enters court in a wheelchair. barely resembling the menacing figure he once was.
Why didn't you want to be in the courtroom to hear all that testimony? Some of it graphic in nature.
It's a matter of needing to be there. I wanted the jury to know that we were there, to know that we cared.
Sabrina was also encompassed, her face, in duct tape.
These were not bodies on a slab. These were real people.
It covered her eyes, her nose, and her mouth.
The prosecution has a powerful case against Hirschfeld, starting with the DNA match.
You cannot make somebody's DNA appear on evidence.
Lead defense attorney Linda Parisi.
That Mr. Hirschfeld is wrongfully accused.
Does not deny it's Hirschfeld's DNA on the blanket, but insists it could have gotten there some other way.
His DNA just magically appeared on its own on this blanket.
I don't think it magically appeared at all. The van was open. During that period of time, Mr. Hirschfeld was in transition in terms of having a residence. And in fact, a person was seen sleeping in that van.
That just makes no sense whatsoever, that someone who is a sexual predator happened upon a van that just was used in a double homicide and somehow deposited his semen.
Prosecutor Dawn Blade points out Sabrina's DNA was found mixed in with Hirschfeld's, evidence of a sexual assault.
That tells you that they were there at the same time.
Then there's Joseph Hirschfeld's suicide note, implicating his brother Richard in the murders. Over defense objections,
the people call Lana Hirschfeld.
The jury hears from Joseph's widow, Lana.
I then called Joseph to tell him that some detectives had been to her home and that they wanted to question him.
It was 2002. Shortly after the DNA hit, when investigators came calling, Lana sent them to Joseph's workplace.
When he came home, can you describe how he was acting?
He was very upset, and he was very red-faced.
Was that normal for him?
No, he was actually a very calm person.
The next night, Lana discovered her husband's body in his car, along with that suicide note.
But I've been living with this horror for 20 years. I was there. My DNA is there.
The prosecutor reads only part of that note to the jury because the defense has succeeded in getting the most incriminating part redacted. What the jury doesn't hear or see is this. Richard did commit those murders, and I didn't kill anyone.
We didn't believe that the suicide note is relevant or reliable. When people are planning their own death, it is not at all uncommon for them to rewrite history.
The prosecutor wants the jury to have no doubt which brother was capable of committing the murders. Judge Michael Sweet allows testimony from Richard Hirschfeld's other victims because of similarities in the crimes. The woman Hirschfeld raped in 1975, Marge, is eager to help put him away for good.
I think we've wasted enough time, enough energy, enough years. I think he should get the death penalty.
Marge takes the stand and confronts her rapist for the second time in 37 years.
He took off his clothes, everything but his t-shirt, and then he sat on the couch.
And where was the gun?
He was still holding it.
Was he pointing it anywhere?
At my head. I could feel it on my temple.
Marge's words are chilling as she identifies her attacker.
Do you recognize the man in that photo?
Yes, I do.
And who is that?
Richard Joseph Hirschfeld.
And how do you know him?
I will never forget him. He is the man that raped me in 1975.
Whoever did this had a...
Faced with such damaging testimony, defense attorney Parisi decides her best strategy is to point the finger right back at the Hunt Group, in spite of the DNA pointing elsewhere.
The focus is really on this Dave Hunt Group.
This group was exonerated years ago.
They were not exonerated. It was not where there was a finding that they were not involved. It was a finding that their DNA did not match with what was found on the blanket. We would ask to call Raymond Gonzalez.
The defense's star witness is a paid police informant who at one point committed robberies with David Hunt.
Good morning, Mr. Gonzalez.
48 hours agreed not to show his face. In 1987, detectives sent Ray Gonzalez to meet with Hunt associate Richard Thompson to try to get him to implicate David Hunt in the murders.
Did he tell you about his participation in these murders?
Yes, he did.
What did he tell you?
We talked, and he had indicated that him and David Hunt were involved in it.
You asked him some questions about that guy putting up a struggle. Do you have a recollection of that conversation?
Talking about John Riggins?
Yes,
Because he put up a struggle, and David settled him down real quick. Apparently he had hit him with some sort of object or something and settled him down real quick.
Although he was supposed to be secretly recording this meeting with Thompson, Gonzalez failed to get any of this alleged confession on tape.
You're asking me a lot of things I don't even remember. Some of the things I just don't recall.
And maybe that's because he had 16 beers that night.
How many beers did you have?
I don't recall. A couple, two or three beers.
Do you recall testifying previously in 1992 that you had about 7 in the motel room and another 9 in the bar?
I don't recall that.
If you had testified to that, would you have been testifying truthfully?
Mm-hmm. But I don't recall.
Okay. Ray Gonzalez is not an uncommon type of witness that we see. He's gotten cash for snitching on various people since he was a teenager.
While Gonzalez spent a great deal of time on the stand saying he couldn't remember, for David Hunt, this is one case he'd rather forget.
How does it feel right now with the Hunt Group back in the news?
Well, it sucks. This was such an ugly thing from the beginning. You know, just a straight, ugly, horrible story. I'm just tired of it.
David Hunt and his crime associate, Richard Thompson, figured quite prominently.
In the end, the defense never called on David Hunt to testify, and he was greatly relieved. He says he left his criminal life behind long ago and found redemption through his Christian faith.
I've done my best to straighten my life out. That's all I can do.
I understand that you're very, very ill.
I have stage 4 cancer, pancreatic cancer, and it probably won't last that long.
Hunt is hoping to live to see his name cleared once and for all with a guilty verdict against Hirschfield.
My name is Richard Riggins, and I am the father of John Riggins.
And as the case draws to a close,
our John and Sabrina were simply destroyed and left to die.
Sabrina and John's families are hoping they can help make that verdict happen.
I am physically sickened and enraged when I think of the terror, pain, and horror they must have felt as they died in a ditch.
The case against Richard Hirschfield is about to be handed to the jury, and the stakes couldn't be any higher.
He deserves death?
Absolutely.
And you didn't hesitate?
No.
Prosecutor Dawn Blade delivers an emotional closing argument.
I struggle because these crimes are so incomprehensible. They are so horrific that none of these words really capture the kind of evil that happened that night.
Blade reminds the jury of the strong physical evidence.
That DNA on that blanket is sex. Semen is sex. This is a sexual crime.
To cast doubt on the DNA, Linda Parisi suggests the blanket could have been contaminated through careless handling by investigators.
They put it in this bag. We didn't make up this bag. This bag isn't a stage prop. This bag is the for real bag.
Blade doesn't mince words as she pounces on that other defense theory of how Hirschfield's DNA might have gotten on that blanket.
So now what do they suggest to you? He's the random masturbator. Just happens to have the urge to relieve himself on an item inside that van.
It is November 5th, 2012.
We've been waiting and waiting and waiting. That's so good. Nervous.
The jury of 7 men and 5 women deliberates less than 3 hours.
We, the jury, in the above entitled cause,
the verdict,
find the defendant Richard Joseph Hirschfield guilty.
Guilty in the murders of both John and Sabrina.
Oh my God.
It is a huge relief for the families.
We won't be able to bring him back.
nor supreme. But we hope this is the beginning of justice for this horrendous case.
The jury reconvenes 3 weeks later for sentencing.
The people call Dr. Richard Riggins
to decide whether Richard Hirschfield deserves the death penalty.
Visualizing the way he died, you know, wrapped up in tape, throat cut, thrown in a ditch, trying to breathe, knowing he's dying, and scared.
A private man, Dr. Richard Riggins has never so publicly shared the deep pain of his loss.
I wasn't there, and there was nothing I could do. So I'd failed in my biggest duty to him.
And there is more gut-wrenching testimony from Sabrina's mother.
This is really hard for me. I don't like to cry in front of other people. And I really don't like to cry in front of him. It ripped my heart out, and it killed me. Or I wish it had. I wish it had been me. You love your kids, and you want the best for them, their whole life.
That has to do with While the prosecutor pushes for the death penalty, defense attorney Parisi hopes the jury will show mercy and spare Hirschfield's life.
Mr. Hirschfield didn't have an easy life. Some will say he didn't have a chance.
His mother was raped by Mr. Hirschfield's father. His father was a very cruel man, physically, emotionally abusive.
A lot of people have horrendous childhoods, and they do not go out and murder and torture and become pedophiles.
You had indicated earlier.
And Parisi believes there's another reason her client cannot help being prone to violence.
These are very abnormal scans. This constitutes brain damage. This term.
Defense witness Dr. Douglas Tucker has studied MRIs of Hirschfield's brain.
This is a serious brain abnormality in an area of the brain that's involved with emotional processing and control over behavior.
Okay, you're not saying that he can't exercise free will?
No, I'm not saying anything like that.
Not saying that he's not capable of making decisions about what is right and what is wrong?
I'm not saying that.
And you're not even saying that he's mentally ill, correct?
I'm not saying that.
The case goes to the jury for the second time.
He chose death over life for John and Sabrina. He chose murder over mercy for his victims that day.
This is the time to punish, but it's time for the killing to stop.
This time they deliberate for only 2 hours.
We, the jury, find that the penalty shall be death.
It is the order of this court that you shall suffer the death penalty.
And as Judge Michael Sweet later upholds the death sentence, he directly addresses Sabrina and John's families. It is January 25th, 2013, 32 years after the murders.
You have endured so much. The tortured history of this case must have taken away any hope you had that the person responsible for these acts would be discovered and held to answer. And it's my sincere and deep felt apologies for the tragedies you have suffered.
Richard Hirschfield is evil. He is a very evil man, and this is a very appropriate penalty. If you think about Hirschfield's contributions to society, what has he contributed? He's contributed humiliation, pain, and death.
I can't believe it. It's over. I'm so relieved. I'm so happy.
And the families are forever grateful to the prosecutor who finally closed this case, a case she herself will never forget.
Did you make a silent promise to these young victims?
More than once, yeah. And I felt gratitude that I was able to come through for them.
I know that you'll never forget her, but emotionally, are you free now?
I'm not free because I miss her. But he's out of our life. We never have to think about him again. I can just miss her. I can just think about that. And I'm really, we're really ready to do that.
Richard Hirschfield remains on death row, but California now has a moratorium on the death penalty. David Hunt died during the trial without seeing his name cleared.